This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Even if there were only one communist in the State Department, that would still be one communist too many.
Senator Joseph McCarthy there on February 9th, 1950, in Wheeling, West Virginia. That iconic and infamous speech in which McCarthy waved a piece of paper before the crowd, a list of 205 names of supposed communists who'd infiltrated the State Department. Now, McCarthy never produced any evidence that there was even one communist in the State Department, but he had struck a chord, and he launched the Red Scare. The anti-communist witch hunt lasted approximately 4 years under McCarthy, but there was another contemporary scare that lasted even longer. On February 28th, 1950, so just a few weeks after McCarthy's original speech, U.S. Undersecretary of State John Purefoy testified that since 1947, the State Department had dismissed some 200 employees who were considered poor security risks. But what risk exactly did they pose? Well, Purefoy said that for more than 90 of those civil servants, they were purged, quote, for moral weakness. Most of them were homosexual. In fact, I would say all of them were, end quote. 2 weeks later, on March 14th, 1950, McCarthy also accused gay civil servants of being a national threat by saying, quote, the official position of the State Department, namely, is that homosexuals are poor security risks. It certainly gives the country an odd idea of the type of individuals who are running things down here, end quote. This was the Lavender Scare. It lasted much, much longer and ruined many lives. The scurrilous linkage between communism and the gay community was pushed by politicians for decades. Listen to the clear line that President Richard Nixon draws in a 1971 Oval Office recording.
You see, homosexuality, though immorality generally, these are the enemies of strong societies. That's why the communists and the left-wingers are pushing each other. They're trying to destroy us.
Well, in his new book, James Kirchick digs both further back and then forward in time. And he tells the story of how LGBTQ civil servants both served and were persecuted in every presidential administration from Franklin Delano Roosevelt through Bill Clinton. His new book is Secret City: The Hidden History of Gay Washington. And Kirchick is also a columnist for Tablet Magazine, a writer-at-large for Airmail, and non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and he joins us from New York. James Kirchick, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, there's something particular about Washington, D.C. that you point out in the book, James, that how it was both an extremely gay and anti-gay city at the same time. Set the stage for us. Why do you say that?
Well, I think that the skills or the traits that make you successful in Washington, things like discretion, being able to keep secrets, being able to work long hours for a boss, maybe to pick up that phone call at 2 a.m. and, you know, rush over to the Capitol to attend to whatever he needs. These are the sorts of things that during this era of the, you know, 40s to the 90s, I think, that gay people, and really gay men in particular, because let's not forget this was an era when men ruled Washington. There were very few women in any sort of positions of influence. These are the sorts of jobs that that gay people, I think, were sort of uniquely able to do, because when you're living in the closet, you have to be able to master these sorts of traits. You also don't have a family to take care of, and so you can devote more time, you can work longer hours. And so particularly with the New Deal and the rise of the federal bureaucracy, you had lots of gay people moving to Washington, particularly from rural areas, trying to, you know, escape perhaps more conservative small town life and seeking a life in the big city, which really is the story of gay people in 20th century America, leaving small towns and coming to big cities. So that's why I would say was often the gayest place in America, the gayest city in America. But there's this paradox. It's also the most anti-gay city in America, because the federal government doesn't allow gay people to work in these jobs officially. And so you have lots of gay people hiding. They're forced to construct these closets that they live in. And it sets a very high amount of tension for them working in Washington.
Mm. Now, in the book, you tell the many stories of individuals who both served and were, as I said, persecuted for being gay during this time period that you're focusing on. But first of all, tell us why go from FDR to Bill Clinton? What is it about that sweep of U.S. history that you felt is particularly important to focus on?
Sure. Well, homosexuality was, has been condemned in sort of Western civilization or Judeo-Christian civilization, and certainly in America for hundreds of years. I mean, you can just go back and read the laws that were imposed by the American colonies, and homosexuality was illegal in all 50 states, and it was considered a medical condition. But I think what happens around World War II or around the FDR, the late FDR period, is that homosexuality goes from being just a sin or a medical condition to becoming a national security threat. And the reason is because of secrecy, really the title of my book, and that the United States needs to build a national security bureaucracy for managing secret information, confidential information. And this notion of national security becomes a primary concern in Washington. And the fear is that gay people or homosexuals, with the term that was used at the time, are really sexual deviants or perverts, that they have the worst possible secret imaginable and that they would go to any length to keep it, and that therefore that makes them very susceptible to blackmail. And so it's not until the Roosevelt administration that we see a government official being hounded out of office, a high-ranking one, actually, Sumner Wells, the Undersecretary of State. Mm-hmm. This is the opening chapters of my book. He's a very talented diplomat, a friend of the Roosevelt family. But his enemies, his rivals within the administration, obtain information that he's gay, and they try to use this, and they use it successfully to get him out of government. And I don't think that if this had happened in the 1920s or 1930s, I'm not sure that it would have risen to the level that it did. But with America entering the world as a global superpower, they could use this argument that, well, Wells is a homosexual, he's therefore susceptible to blackmail by foreign powers. So that's why the book begins with World War II.
I want to spend some time talking in detail about Wells, because the story you tell about him is quite amazing. But before we do that, though, we should make the point, as you write about in the book, that this presumption that that gay members of the State Department or quite frankly, anywhere in Washington were somehow more vulnerable to blackmail by communists was never actually proven. There was never, even decades later, an iota of proof that ever happened.
Yeah, I think it sort of makes, even if you're a liberal-minded, enlightened person, it sort of on the face might make some sense, the rationale, because you would say, oh, well, yes, in the 1940s, homosexuality was widely condemned, and it therefore, you wouldn't necessarily need to be a homophobic bigot to think that this policy makes sense. But it wasn't based on any sort of evidence. And in fact, the only evidence that was ever cited was the case of a counterintelligence official in the Austro-Hungarian army in 1913 who was spying for the Russians, and he was gay. But it turns out that the reason he was handing over information to the Russians was not because he was being blackmailed. It was because he was greedy and he wanted money. But the legend or the myth of this man, Colonel Alfred Radel, was so significant. I mean, Alan Dulles, who's the first civilian director of the CIA, he writes about it multiple times, and Western intelligence officials in multiple countries across the West would often cite the Radel case as the example, the sort of paradigmatic example of the traitorous homosexual. But there was no evidence for it. And then in the 1990s, the Defense Department actually did a study of over 100 cases of people violating the Espionage Act. And there's not a single instance of a gay person doing it for the reasons of being blackmailed. So there's no basis to it whatsoever.
Well, yeah, because in fact, the opposite happened, is that they were outed by their own nation. right? And
well, that's the problem. Yeah. And I mean, the argument that was made by the early gay rights activists was that by, you know, creating this category of people who are so beyond the pale, the homosexual, you're actually giving your enemies, your foreign adversaries, those intelligence agencies, you're giving them a form of leverage over these gay employees, because you're creating this vulnerability that shouldn't exist. And if you just told your gay State Department employees or gay CIA employees, look, just tell us you're gay, and then there's no problem with it at that point, then there wouldn't be this threat of blackmail. But that obviously didn't happen.
Well, and then ultimately, again, we will get into some of the specific, like, very compelling stories that you tell in the book, James. But I just want to drive home this point that what happened to so many people is that the United States essentially did the work for the Soviets, even if the Soviets yes. had been interested in doing that, right? Because people right. were purged out of government.
Absolutely.
Their lives were ruined. And these were some of them. I mean, it didn't matter really where they were in government, but some of them also happened to be extremely high ranking, influential, you know, completely qualified servants of the government. And we took them out of government and ruined yeah. their lives on our own.
Well, I actually interviewed the man who was the first gay person to receive a security clearance as an openly gay person. It actually happened in 1980. I interviewed him for the book, and he was a linguist for the NSA, for the National Security Agency. And somehow, he still doesn't know, but he has suspicions. Somehow someone outed him to his bosses, and they came to him and they said, look, you're a homosexual, we're going to have to fire you. And he said to them, look, I am out of the closet, and I'm willing to even tell my family, I'm willing to serve my country. And the head of the NSA at the time said, okay, if you, you know, write a letter to your closest family members and you actually prove this to us, you can continue serving. And he was allowed to serve. He was allowed to maintain his security clearance. And that was the first time that happened in 1980. He suspects to this day that it was probably a foreign intelligence agency, which perhaps gave the information to the U.S. government because they wanted to get rid of him because he was a very talented translator and they wanted to get him fired.
Huh. Yeah, so why blackmail when you can just give the information to our own government and they'll do the work for you? Well, we're talking today with James Kirchick. His new book is Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington, and there are many more stories that James has uncovered that we'll talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and James Kirchick is with us today. He's author of the new book, Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington. So, James, let's talk about Sumner Wells. I actually love how you describe him in the early pages of the book. You describe him as being like basically such the bluest of New England blue bloods, so much so that he practically shimmers indigo. But so tell us a little bit about Sumner Wells and who he was before he even arrived in government.
Well, yeah, Sumner Wells, he's a friend of the Roosevelts. He's very top of his class at Harvard. He becomes one of the youngest members of the State Department, one of the head of the Latin America Bureau at the age of 29, extremely talented diplomat. He served as ambassador to Cuba, and he's serving as the Undersecretary of State in the Roosevelt administration, the FDR administration, when he's riding on the presidential train coming back from the funeral of the Speaker of the House. And he drunkenly propositions a number of porters on the train. And this story gets into the hands of some of his enemies in Washington, namely the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, who's a conservative, was a conservative Democratic senator from Tennessee. And Roosevelt didn't like Hull. He didn't really rely on him. He just sort of needed him to maintain the support of the Southern Democrats in his coalition. And so Hull teams up with another man, a former diplomat named William Bullitt, who's a fascinating character in his own right. He was the first ambassador to the Soviet Union. He was ambassador to France. And he also resents Wells. Both of them resent Wells because basically FDR is relying on Wells as his de facto Secretary of State. And so in their hands, homosexuality becomes a weapon that they can use as a political weapon that they can use to destroy a rival. And FDR at the outset wants to protect Wells. He has a sort of a very deep loyalty to friends. He also, according to his son Elliot, is willing to forgive a man pretty much anything if he's drunk at the time. You have to remember this is the 1940s, and we're talking about a particular class of elite aristocratic men, and these are sorts of the rules that they lived by. But even FDR had to relent after about 2 years because the story was getting into the hands of senators on Capitol Hill, and they were threatening to launch an investigation. And so this becomes the first firing of a government official on account of his sexual orientation.
Hmm. And what happened to him after that?
It's a very sad story. He basically descends into alcoholism, and he kind of withers away. I mean, he writes a couple of books. He maybe goes on some lecture tours. But then in 1956, so this is 13 years after he's been fired, in 1956, Confidential magazine, which was really one of the first sort of supermarket tabloids, huge readership, millions of readers. And this was the magazine that really sort of that pioneered the concept of outing, of exposing public figures for their homosexuality. And it does this with some Hollywood stars. It famously outs the Hollywood actor Tab Hunter. They out Sumner Wells in 1956 with a huge front page story exposing him and exposing the incident on the train. And it's really all downhill for him from that point.
Hmm. Now, you make a really interesting point in the book. If we can just refocus a little bit on the mm-hmm. State Department itself, because, of course, the State Department and accusations made about State Department employees later on become central to this story. But you seem to make the point that, in fact, because of freedoms that members of the diplomatic corps might have had by, you know, living in different countries, et cetera, that, in fact, the State Department did have a large number of gay civil servants in it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a number on this. It's hard to say. But, I mean, there was sort of an understanding or perhaps a perception that because you were able to live overseas and you could also be a bachelor, people weren't exactly going to be suspicious if you were a diplomat living for long tours overseas and traveling and not having a wife and family, that these sorts of conditions made it a somewhat more attractive place for gay people, for gay men, again, because this is a very male-dominated era in American politics. So there are a number of gay men that I come across who are not necessarily living the most open lives, but there are a number of them serving in the 1930s and 40s. And then when we get to McCarthy, I think part of this sort of reputation that the State Department has as, you know, this term cookie pushers, right, that they're just serving tea and they're very dainty and they're very effeminate. And the State Department becomes associated with homosexuality because they're effeminate and they're pushing diplomacy over military solutions to diplomatic problems and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so that part of that reputation that the State Department had as being something of a haven for gay people in earlier decades becomes used by McCarthy and his allies in the 1950s.
Right. So the story of Wells, though, is obviously it's much more than the story of, you know, an aristocratic playboy who was outed and then or actually, you know, who was forced out of his job at the State Department. Because I wonder, what did the Roosevelt administration lose by pushing him out of his job, given especially sort of the condition of the world at the time?
Yeah, I mean, he's a brilliant diplomat. He's responsible for the Atlantic Charter, which is sort of the great declaration of the aims of the Allies in World War II. He also is the author of the Wells Declaration, which is the official statement of U.S. non-recognition of the Russian the Soviet annexation of the Baltic states, which is a very relevant policy even to this day. I mean, we don't recognize the Russian occupation of Crimea, which is based on the same principles of the Wells Declaration. So he's a brilliant diplomat. And then, you know, again, this is counterfactual, but Sumner Wells was one of the most sympathetic members of the Roosevelt administration towards the plight of the Jews during the Holocaust. And it's a worthwhile question to ask. If he had not been purged, you know, might the Roosevelt administration adopted policies that would have allowed more Jewish refugees coming into the United States, because they hardly accepted any? And this is a question that you just have to ask, I think, when I was working on this book for years, and I think it's one of the main takeaways of this book, is you just have to stop and contemplate, you know, what did our country lose by purging thousands of patriotic Americans who wanted to serve their country from their jobs? And what talents and skills was our country denied by preventing gay people from working in government? It's an unquantifiable answer to that question.
Well, so in Secret City, you organize the book by administration. So let's move forward to the Truman administration, because, of course, you know, here we have McCarthyism and this distillation of the sort of perhaps the most public distillation of the supposed connection between communism and homosexuality in the United States. It's also, I would say, maybe the best known period of U.S. history regarding this issue that you cover. So what is it about in the Truman administration you think that hasn't been discussed enough, or that you pulled out of your historical examination?
Well, I spend a lot of time on the Alger Hiss Whitaker Chambers case, which is really the first spy drama of the American Cold War, the domestic spy drama. And it involves a senior editor of Time magazine named Whitaker Chambers, who comes out in 1948 and accuses a man named Alger Hiss, who had been a high-ranking State Department official, of having been a communist. And this becomes it's the first televised hearing in congressional hearing in American history. And there's a homoerotic subtext to this whole drama that is never really spoken of explicitly at the time, because homosexuality was such a taboo topic. But Chambers had a gay past. He had lived as a gay man in the 1930s while he himself was working as a spy or as a courier in the communist underground. And so the Hiss side of Hiss and his defenders start a whisper campaign to defend Hiss, basically saying that Chambers is a spurned homosexual, that he wanted and desired Hiss, and that Hiss rejected him, and that the reason why he's lodging these accusations against Alger Hiss is because of his, you know, homosexual mania and his sort of homosexual obsession. And this is, again, it's not spoken of explicitly, but it people in Washington, in politics and media, and in New York as well, where Chambers was working at Time magazine, they all sort of know this rumor, and it's right there beneath the surface. And this begins to establish in a lot of people's minds, at least prominent people, that there's this association between communism and homosexuality, right? So communists, like homosexuals, they live in the shadows, they lurk in the shadows, they're living a double life. You can't really tell from the outside whether someone is a communist or a homosexual. It's a secret life. It's a secret existence. And that homosexuals are sexual subversives. Communists are political subversives. And so there's this association between the two of them. And so the Hiss Chambers case, I mean, it's a fascinating moment in American history. It's a very influential one. I mean, for decades, you could pretty much, you know, tell where someone's political beliefs were, where they rested on the political spectrum if you asked them their views on this. It was a very divisive case. And Whitaker Chambers obviously goes off to become one of the most important leaders of the or intellectual forces behind the American conservative movement. But there is a whole homosexual subtext to that case that I explore in the book. And Richard Nixon, this is when Richard Nixon becomes a national political figure. He's a young congressman from California, and he champions Whitaker Chambers. And decades later, when he's president of the United States, Nixon is telling his aides that, you know, Chambers and Hiss, they were both that way. That's the way he described them. That was to him, even though he believed Hiss was guilty, he also believed that the two of them had a gay affair. So this hasn't really been written about that much, but I found a lot of it to be quite interesting.
Hmm. Well, of course, we can't get into satisfactory detail of any in any portion of your book, James, because the research is quite monumental. So I just want to push forward and sort of jump a little bit to a couple of other administrations. And so in the Johnson administration, moving forward quite significantly here, when campaigning for re-election in 1964, as you write in the book, news had broken that Johnson's top aide, Walter Jenkins, was caught in a specific affair. And so that affair roiled the Johnson administration, and questions were asked reactions were requested from many other politicians, including New York Senator Jacob Javits. So here is a reporter asking a question of Javits.
Senator, what's your feelings on this Jenkins affair? Is it a fair issue in the campaign?
Well, I think it's a most unhappy and tragic issue in terms of the people involved. Whether or not it can be an issue or should be an issue in the campaign will depend upon what connection it has with national security, if any.
So what was the Jenkins affair?
Yeah, so Walter Jenkins was the closest aide to Lyndon Johnson, had been working with him since Johnson was a young congressman from Texas. He's referred to many times by people who knew Johnson as being Johnson's slave. He had five children and was an upstanding Catholic, but just devoted his life to Lyndon Johnson. And then 3 weeks before the 1964 election, which, by the way, Johnson would go on to win in a landslide, and all the indications were that he was going to win in a landslide, Walter Jenkins is arrested in the bathroom of the YMCA around the corner from the White House for having sex with another man. And they are able to keep this story a secret for about a week. The newspapers, they're able to persuade the major newspapers not to write anything about it. You have to remember, again, this is Washington in the 1960s, and just the media and government operated in a different way. It was not the sort of adversarial relationship that they have today. But then the story leaks, it breaks. And it's funny, when I talk to people of a certain age, people who are young, maybe in their teens around this time in 1964, they told me this is where they first learned about homosexuality, right? That it was something that was not spoken of as a topic. But then it was on the front pages all across the country of every newspaper. And their parents would have to explain to them, you know, what this man was doing in a public bathroom and why was he there? And it just sort of shows you the way that people understood homosexuality. It was not presented to them as, you know, two people falling in love and having a healthy, loving relationship. It was, you know, it was a married man with five children in a dank basement bathroom of a YMCA seeking sex with a stranger. And that's what homosexuality was to people. That's the only way that they could conceive of it. And Johnson was paranoid about this, and he thought he could not conceive of how Walter Jenkins, who he knew for a quarter of a century, he could not conceive of how his aide would be doing this. He assumed, or he was demanding that his aides find out whether or not the Soviets set him up, that maybe the waiter at the party where Jenkins had been before he did this, maybe he spiked Walter's drink with some sort of drug that made him behave this way. Mm. He suspected that the Barry Goldwater campaign, Goldwater being his Republican opponent at the time, he suspected that the Goldwater campaign was responsible for it. And he was concerned that it was actually going to lose him the election. And it was one of the surprises to a lot of people. In fact, many leading media figures thought that this might be able to swing the election in Goldwater's direction. But he ended up winning in a landslide. And I think it shows you that perhaps the public attitudes were somewhat ahead of those of the Washington media elites, that the actual public did not think, as Senator Javits said, that there was necessarily a connection to national security here, and that just because Walter Jenkins had this sort of troubling personal defect, that that necessarily meant that he had, you know, given nuclear codes to the Soviet Union.
Right. And when you say troubling personal defect, that's how it was considered in Washington.
Yes, but absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, we have about 30 seconds to go before the next break, James. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just give you a quick chance to tell us why writing this book was actually so personally important to you and understanding this history or uncovering some of this history.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm gay, and I think as a gay person, we don't have a way of learning our history through, you know, older relatives or family. It's not like if you're African American and you can learn the history of slavery through your ancestors, or if you're Jewish, you learn the history of your people at the Passover Seder table. If you're gay, you don't have that generational connection to other gay people. You have to discover it for yourself. And so that's what really motivated me to pursue this project.
Well, James Kirchick's new book is Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington. And we'll talk more about it, including about the Reagan administration, when we come back. This is On Point.
I'm Kathleen Goldhar, and I'm the host of a new podcast, Crime Story. Every week, we bring you a different crime, told by the storyteller who knows it best.
You got one witness who can't be found. You got another witness who's murdered.
We couldn't sugarcoat the story.
I was getting calls from Cosby's attorney threatening to sue every day.
Every crime in one way or another is a reflection of who we are as a people, as a city, as a country.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And just a heads up on something we're working on for next week. We're going to talk about the concept of empathetic joy. It's the type of joy that you find in other people's happiness. Maybe when a friend gets a dream job, or when you see a child experiencing that sort of unencumbered joy of being on the playground. So we want to hear stories from you about moments where you've experienced empathetic joy. What happened? What was the circumstances? How did it change you? Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Also interested in the flip side as well. Do you find yourself these days being unable to experience or rejoice in the joy of others? Again, 617-353-0683. That's for next week. This week we're talking with James, or today we're talking with James Kirchick. He's author of Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington. And James, if I could, I would love to spend a couple of minutes talking about what the story you tell about the Reagan administration. So first of all, here's a little bit of tape. This is in 1982. When asked about the Reagan administration's response to the AIDS epidemic at the time, this is at a White House briefing in October of 1982, Deputy Press Secretary Larry Speakes said the administration had no response.
Does the president have any reaction to the announcement of the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta that AIDS is now an epidemic, over 600 cases? It's known as gay plague. No, it is. I mean, it's a pretty serious thing that one in every three people that get this have died, and I wondered if the president is aware of it.
I don't have it. Are you? Do you?
You don't have it. Well, I'm relieved to hear that, Larry.
Do you?
Delighted. No,
you
I don't.
You didn't answer my question.
Well, I just wondered,
how do you know?
Does the president, in other words, the White House looks on this as a great joke?
No, I don't know anything about it, Lester.
Does anybody at the White House know about this epidemic, Larry?
I don't think so. I don't think there's been any.
Nobody knows.
There's been no personal experience here, Lester.
So, James, what's interesting about that is what Speaks does. First of all, he doesn't answer the reporter's question. And second of all, he takes the opportunity to insist that no one in the White House has AIDS. Why did he go to great lengths to say that?
Well, one of the things, or I could say themes or themes that I discovered in this book is that there's a real sense of estrangement and fear around the Reagan people, Ronald Reagan himself, his wife Nancy, his top advisors, of being seen as gay, and that there's the sense that because he comes from Hollywood, he's an actor, he comes from an actor's background, that he may himself be perceived as gay. And there's actually a line in one of his top aide, Lynn Nofziger's books, his memoir, that they were concerned when he was running for governor in 1966 that because of his Hollywood association, he might be perceived as gay. And in Reagan's memoir that he published in 1965 before announcing his run for governor, he's talking about one of the films that he was making in 1939, Dark Victory, with the actress Betty Davis. And he's basically playing her gay best friend. And of course, they couldn't be explicit about this because you could not portray homosexuality explicitly in the movies. There was a code, the MPAA code, against portrayals of homosexuality. But the director was giving Reagan instructions, and this is the way that Reagan recounts it. He says he wanted me to play the role as if I was the sort of fellow who could sit in the girls' dressing room and dish with the ladies while they're getting dressed, which is a very long sort of euphemistic way of describing a gay man, right? And he's very put off by this and offended and upset of having to play a role this way. And so even being an actor and even portraying a gay character on screen makes him uncomfortable. And then in 1967, the first year of his governorship, he's rocked by a gay scandal when a newspaper columnist alleges that Reagan that there was a ring of gay men working in his gubernatorial office in Sacramento, and that they had an orgy at a timeshare house in Lake Tahoe. And this is published in newspapers across the country, and Reagan is furious about this. He's furious that this becomes public. And then in 1980, one of the things that I uncovered, really one of the big scoops in the book, is that a group of Republicans, actually moderate Republicans, bring new accusations of gay advisors surrounding Ronald Reagan to the Washington Post. They allege that there's a network of right-wing homosexuals basically controlling Ronald Reagan as if he were a Manchurian candidate. This is actually in a memo that one of these congressmen wrote, and I found it. And they brought it to Ben Bradley, the legendary executive editor of the Washington Post, and he gets his best team of reporters to investigate this. And so I think that just and then, of course, you know, the Reagans had a lot of gay friends. I mean, Nancy in particular, there's a page in my book in the inserts, the photo inserts. I have an entire page called All the First Lady's Men, and it's just photos of Nancy with all her gay courtiers and hairdressers and fashion designers. So there's just this aura of gayness around the Reagans. I don't know how else to describe it. And I think that, coupled with the fact that he had this new block of voters who were supporting him, right, the evangelical Christians, they're a new force in American politics. They don't emerge until the late 1970s, and they really propel him into office. And I think there's just this hesitancy and this fear of being seen too close to anything gay. And so when you play that tape of that press conference, and you hear the laughter and the sense of distancing, and just, you know, there's no one in here in this building that has this disease, I think it reflects that. I would also point out, by the way, it's not just the Reagans who are treating, or the Reagan administration that's treating this disease as sort of a joke. You can listen to all those reporters laughing about it. You know, the entire press room, right, was laughing at this question. And in fact, the reporter who asked the question about AIDS, it tells you a lot about the time, was a man named Lester Kinsolving, who was a kind of crank right-wing conspiracy theorist. And so that he was the guy asking about AIDS. No mainstream journalist was even bothering to ask about this disease that was killing, you know, disproportionately gay men. That was the state of the conversation in America at that time.
Well, there's another figure that you write about in the Reagan years. We can't spend a lot of time talking about him, but I'm just going to briefly describe him to set up a bigger question for you, James. And this is Terry Dolan, of course, the co-founder of the National Conservative Political Action Committee. And Dolan once told Larry Kramer, right, the legendary gay activist, about fighting for the gay community from the inside, that Dolan could do that. Now he ends up, Dolan ends up dying from AIDS. He wasn't even 40, right? I think he was
36.
36. But he never really evidenced that there isn't any evidence that you or other historians and writers found that Dolan actually...
I found one little letter that he wrote sort of trying to tell his friends in the conservative movement to kind of lay off
one gay little
people.
Letter.
That
okay.
was it. One letter.
So
yeah.
The reason why I bring it up is because a reviewer of your book in The New Yorker basically says that one of the big lessons from Secret City, from your book, is that it's not so much about any kind of activism that happened within, the halls of Washington by gay people who were working there under the threat of being outed, but more that their activism, if any, came after they were pushed out of Washington. And the reviewer says the story is really of the quietly queer politico who looks the other way when it comes to policies that devastated fellow queer people. And I wonder what you thought of that.
Well, I definitely think that to be a powerful person in Washington in this period, it was impossible to be gay or to be openly gay, right? And so that's certainly true, and that you didn't, and that therefore it was very rare or almost impossible to see an openly gay official, positively pushing for change. But I do think that you have to look a little bit lower down the bureaucratic ladder during the power structure. And you have to understand that in 1975, the Civil Service Commission lifted its ban on gay people being able to work in the civil service. And this actually puts Washington, D.C. far ahead most other states in the country, which it would take many years for the rest of the country to adopt anti-discrimination statutes. And so this makes Washington, D.C., it makes the federal bureaucracy actually quite advanced on the issue of gay inclusion. And so in the end of my book, I say, there are all these people whose names we don't know because they were, they were congressional staffers. They were people who worked at the Department of Labor or, any of these government departments, just kind of regular bureaucrats. I mean, that word has a lot of negative connotations, but they're just, thousands of gay men and women who got up every day and went to work. And that put Washington actually far ahead of other states and cities. And I think that was actually really, really important. And they might not have been chiefs of staff. They might not have been senators, right? They might not have been the most important, powerful people in Washington. But you had this openness and this visibility in Washington among regular, normal people that was far ahead of its time.
Yeah. So we've only got about 5 minutes left, James, and there's two really important last areas of exploration I'd like to engage in with you. And it has to do sort of with where we are now as a country today, because so much of one of the things I came away from your book was that decade after decade after decade, gay people working in Washington both could, in a sense, a little bit be who they were, but could not. And I do wonder, you've written before separately that you feel pretty confident that no matter what direction the country goes now, I don't want to misquote you here, James, but mm-hmm. that essentially the sort of push or movement for gay acceptance or gay rights is over, and that the country mm-hmm. can never go back. Do you still feel that way, given sort of what's been happening in some state houses across the country?
Well, I think there's a difference between gay rights and mm-hmm. homophobia. If we're talking about legal equality for gay people are equal citizens in America, full stop. That doesn't mean that there's no more homophobia. Of course not. That doesn't mean that there might not be laws like this law in Florida that's the so-called Don't Say Gay bill that might be perhaps forcing some people back into the closet. But in terms of legal equality, I absolutely believe that we've achieved it in this country, and I think it's one of the lessons of this book is that it's a remarkable journey to go from where gay people were in the Roosevelt administration when they were medically condemned as being mental defectives, when they were legally criminalized and they were religiously condemned from the pulpit, to go from that to where we are today, where it's never been a better time to be gay in America than now. I think that's an extraordinary achievement. And just yesterday, Gallup came out with its latest poll. It showed 71% of Americans support gay marriage, the highest number ever recorded, including a majority of Republicans. And it's, again, you know, you should maybe never say never in this day and age. And but I am quite confident. I mean, when you look across the debates that we have in this country, we can't seem to agree on anything. I mean, I don't in my lifetime, I felt like we've never been more divided, and it's sort of trite to say that, but I think it's true. But on this issue of basic equality for gay people, I think there's actually a consensus in this country. It's one of the very few things on which there is a consensus.
Well, amongst the American people, perhaps, but the question is, is that consensus maintained, say, you know, in not only in state houses, but if a case shows up before the Supreme Court? I mean, I think it's an open question at the moment. And maybe we can have you back sometime, James, to talk more about that. But the reason why I wanted to set that up is because there's also this idea that you and some others have advanced in the past about how it's really important to recognize that in terms of the fight for gay rights, that a full and complete embrace of free speech has been central to that.
Absolutely.
Right. And in fact, you write about Frank Kameny, who we didn't mention this hour, unfortunately, in the book, and how, you know, he utilized the every American's right to free speech to have the first, you know, pickets in front of the White House well before Stonewall. But you have been critical of you know, certain factions of the LGBTQ community now for, you believe, in turning its back on free speech.
Absolutely. It just seems so many of these controversies that we have today over cancel culture, or whatever you want to call it, it seems like most of them stem from these debates we're having over sexual orientation and gender identity. And it's usually, you know, people trying to shut down those who are critical of gay people or gay rights or transgender Americans. They're trying to shut down their ability to speak. And, you know, I may disagree with what a lot of these folks have to say, but they should absolutely be allowed to say it. And I think as gay Americans, we have to be particularly supportive of this right, because there would not be a gay rights movement. There would not be gay equality without an extremely robust First Amendment. I mean, if you go back to, you mentioned Frank Kameny, he's the first person to be fired from the federal government to sue and to fight back. He used the First Amendment. He used his ability to advocate on behalf of a despised minority, a universally despised minority. And he was able to successfully organize, to start an organization called the Mattachine Society, to picket, to write letters to various public officials. The Stonewall Uprising, what was that? It was an uprising against police abuse of the free association rights that we all have as American citizens. So there would not be a gay America. There would not be gay marriage in this country were it not for an extremely robust First Amendment. And that means protecting the rights of everyone to speak, no matter how reprehensible we find their beliefs.
So do you see an irony then in some, you know, pride parade organizers saying that they're not going to allow or invite, you know, gay police officers to march?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, look, I mentioned the Stonewall Uprising. What was that? That was police abusing their powers to beat up and oppress gay people. That was 50 some odd years ago. Now we have police departments all over the country. They're all bending over backwards to support the gay community. And what do? We spit in their faces and tell them that gay police officers, they're not allowed to march in parades wearing their uniforms. I think that's reprehensible.
Well, James Kirchick's new book is Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington. And we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. James, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for the new book as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.